You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 28th, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How's everyone doing?
Pretty good. I mean, I'm
good. Kicking.
What, I got like 4 days now until I'm fully vaccinated? What would you call that?
Vaccinated.
Yeah, and I'm seeing like a ton of people that I know on Facebook are, you know, saying that they got their second shot or, you know, they're fully vaxxed. Super psyched. You know, the thing that I'm not happy about is I read a statistic that said that was like the high 30% of people in the United States are vaccinated. That's it. That's where we're at.
Fully vaccinated, but it's, yeah, for a lot of doses.
Over 200 million have the shot, have at least one shot, right? That's the number I heard in the States.
But a lot of people are not coming for their second shot for the two shots.
Yeah, that's scary.
What's that about?
We knew this was going to be a potential issue, though, when we heard it was going to be a two-shot phenomenon.
Yeah, but we didn't. I mean, yes, we've always known that it's hard to reach certain individuals with the second shot. But it's really bumming me out that a lot of people who are in a perfect position to do it are choosing not to go back for their second shot.
Get your shot. All right, guys, enough COVID talk. I have a story I want to tell you.
Gather around.
Yeah, this is interesting. Right. So I was doing some background research for a project that we're working on that we can't tell you about, not yet. But in any case, it was one of those situations where something that I believed for many years is wrong.
Yes, I love that.
Oh, yeah.
And the bubble.
So it deepens the story. And in fact, we talked about this recently on the show, Bob. We talked about Lord Kelvin and why he was wrong about the age of the Earth. The story that we have been told is basically wrong in a very important way.
So go over that.
I'm going to tell you the whole thing because it's fascinating. And the fact that nobody called us on it means that it is the wrong story that we told is pretty much accepted by most people
prevalent.
And is widespread.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So this is what, I just needed to like confirm a couple of little details. I looked it up, and I came across a story that completely blows it apart.
Okay.
So here's the thing. So, you know, Lord Kelvin is the most famous physicist of the latter half of the, or one of the most famous physicists of the latter half of the 19th century. And he was fighting with the geologists and biologists of the time. Geologists were, at that time, they were coming around to like a uniformitarian kind of approach where Earth as opposed to the earlier catastrophism, where instead of like the geological structures are not all due to like these sudden catastrophic events, it's just continuous slow processes that have been happening over a very long period of time. So they thought the Earth was extremely old, billions of years old, and in some cases they said maybe the Earth is just infinitely old. Maybe this is just
what?
It's like it's a homeostasis. This is just a never-ending process,
right?
And so Kelvin's like, well, that can't be true, because if the Earth has heat and the Earth is cooling, if it were infinitely or even super, super old, it would have cooled by now.
Right.
So he set about to calculate how much the Earth should have cooled, just to put numbers to his, you know, his pushback against the geologist. So he, you know, had worked out a lot of the thermodynamic equations. And so he made the following calculation based on a few assumptions. He said, okay, let's assume that the Earth was a certain temperature when it formed. And he said, and how are we going to figure out what that temperature is? Well, we know what temperature rocks melt at. So let's just say the Earth was the temperature of melting rock when it formed. That's actually roughly correct.
Reasonable.
And it turns out historically to be correct. Said, and then, so the heat should be escaping from the Earth over time. And so we need to know, like, how quickly does heat conduct through rock, through Earth? And we need to measure the temperature gradient of the Earth near the surface. If I have those three measurements, I can plug them into my equations and calculate the age of the Earth. But let me go into a little bit more detail about that. So essentially, the paper that discusses this uses the turkey as an explanation. As an example, assume a spherical turkey, right? You have a spherical turkey. You take it out of the oven at whatever, 400 degrees. You put it in your freezer, and then the heat will escape the turkey. So the heat will conduct through the turkey, and then the surface will cool very quickly, but the heat, the inside, will cool very slowly because the heat needs time to conduct to the surface. So then what you end up having is just this sort of skin of cold turkey on the outside, this sort of crust of cold turkey on the outside, and then hot turkey on the inside. So the same thing would be true for the Earth, is that, you know, you're going to have this crust at the surface of the Earth, and the interior of the Earth will be hot, and you can tell how old the Earth is by the temperature gradient at the surface, because that crust, that cold crust, will get thicker over time as it cools. So he had to wait 15 years to get accurate measurements for the temperature gradient at the surface of the Earth, but he had those measurements. He had measurements of the rate at which Earth conducts heat, and he had measurements for what temperature of the Earth probably was when it started, what the molten rock is. And in fact, those numbers are all reasonably good. And if you plug in modern, hyper-accurate numbers, you get basically the same results that he got 130 years ago. Yeah, so they were
nice job, Kelvin.
Those numbers were good. His equations were good. But he said, also, so what are the assumptions that you have to make? And, you know, so again, what Kelvin was trying to do was apply a simplified model in order to apply basic physical constructs, concepts to the question of, like, you know, the age of the Earth. So he knew he was doing that. That was the whole point. And he said, so the assumptions we're going to make are, one is that the Earth is solid. Two, that the Earth is homogeneous, right? It's basically going to conduct heat the same all the way through.
Right.
And three, that there's no unknown source of energy.
Big one.
So he did that. So with those three assumptions and those three numbers, he plugged in his calculation, and he calculated the age of the Earth to be 100 to 200 million years old. He later revised that down. You know, he kept revising the number down. Eventually, by the end of his life, he was saying 20 million years, but we'll say 20 to 100 million years was the sort of the error bars that he had. He then did the same thing for the sun. He said, let's figure out how old the sun is, assuming that the sun's source of energy is the same. Because remember, this is, you didn't know about nuclear fusion at this point. And he calculated the age of the sun to be 100 million years. And that made him really confident that he was correct, because the age of the sun and the age of the Earth were roughly in agreement, both about 100 million years. So he's like, take that, geologist, you're wrong. The Earth is not infinitely old or even billions of years old. It's only, you know, tens of millions of years old.
Okay.
100, maybe 200, but certainly not more than that. The geologists were like, well, they had a lot of independent lines of evidence from columns and geological structures that said this. Now, these would have taken hundreds of millions of years to form. So you have to be wrong.
Right. You're missing something.
But they also said that you can't apply these models, these physical models, to geology. Geology is just too complicated. And there, Kelvin was right. You can't apply physical models to stuff like that. The problem was that his model was wrong. It's not that you can't apply physical models. So I'm going to skip ahead a little bit to explain why we all think what we do about this. So this was all, you know, 1890s, right? In 1904, Pierre Curie discovered that radioactive decay releases heat.
Dope!
And Rutherford and Curie and other physicists were like, aha! Aha!
Aha!
So Kelvin's third assumption, that there is no other source of heat, is wrong. And because the radioactive decay will heat up the Earth, the substance of the Earth, and that is why the Earth is older than he calculated. Now, they were correct for the sun. That was the wrong assumption that made Kelvin wrong, Lord Kelvin wrong about the sun. Because the sun is not just a hot rock. It's burning hydrogen to helium. Its energy comes from fusion. And in fact, you know, there were people at the time who were saying, you know, there's a lot of unknowns here. We don't know how much energy is stored in atoms and molecules. And it turns out he was correct. There's a lot of energy stored in atoms that we didn't know about. And once we figured out
forces,
nuclear processes, that was very, very prescient. So that became an iconic story about how the discovery of radioactive decay releasing heat into the crust disproved Lord Kelvin.
But and now you're going to ruin that story for
us. Yes, because that's not true. If you do the calculations, the amount of heat being released by radioactive decay in the crust, and really only like the top 100 miles would be relevant to the calculation.
Why?
It has an insignificant effect on Kelvin's calculations. Because it's only that temperature gradient near the surface that matters.
Yeah, but that's impacted by
it is, but it's insignificant. The bottom line is, it doesn't matter how much heat there is sloshing around in the interior, it's just how much heat is there in the gradient towards the crust. So that's not the reason that Kelvin was wrong. The real reason he was wrong was because of one of his other assumptions. And which one do you think it is?
At this point, I have no idea.
So the other two assumptions were the Earth is solid and the Earth is homogeneous.
Homogeneous.
No. Well, I mean, it's not solid.
It's not solid. And at the time, the assumption was, even if it was like at the very core, it was molten, that the mantle and crust were solid, and at least to a pretty extreme depth, you know, like 150 miles or whatever, like to a pretty good depth. I think the conventional wisdom that Kelvin firmly believed was that the Earth was like steel, like it just does not move.
Well, then where'd the magnetosphere come from, huh?
So here's the thing. This is why he's wrong, because he was calculating the movement of heat entirely through conduction, when in fact, heat is moving to the surface through convection.
Yeah.
Through the liquid, you know, Earth moving and physically carrying heat. And if you think about it, so if heat can move from the center of the Earth to the surface of the Earth more quickly, that would keep the temperature gradient at the surface of the Earth higher and give an artificially young calculation for the age of the Earth. And so this was all figured out at the time by one of Lord Kelvin's assistants, a guy by the name of Perry. Figured it out, and he did the calculation. He's like, you know, if the Earth was more liquid underneath the crust than solid, then convection was carrying heat to the surface, and you do those, plug those calculations in, he came up with an age of the Earth of about 2 to 3 billion years. So he was essentially correct. Yeah, billions of years, right? So correct to within an order of magnitude, right? So he was correct. And he went to Kelvin and explained it all to him. And Kelvin refused to listen to him.
Yeah.
This is before radioactivity was even discovered. This is like in those 1890s. Kelvin, either he didn't understand him or he just didn't want to believe him. And so eventually Perry had to publish it. You know, so he published it in Nature.
Ooh, and good for him.
Yeah. But still, it didn't have an impact. Here was the problem. The point of contention was whether or not the Earth could be liquid or not, could move. And Kelvin himself actually gave an example of this in another context. He said, all right, float corks on the top of water, put wax on top of the corks, and then put bullets on top of the wax, right? So the bullets are going to want to sink, the corks are going to want to float. And over the short term, that hardened wax is solid, but come back to it in a month and you will see that the bullets and the corks are embedded in the wax. Come back to it in a year and the bullets will be on the bottom and the corks will be on the top. So wax is a solid over short periods of time and a liquid over long periods of time. And so Perry said the same thing is true of the Earth. It's solid over short time spans, but it's liquid. It can flow really slowly, but it can flow given millions of years, right? So over geological timescales, the Earth flows. It's liquid. And that convection would heat the surface, would increase the temperature gradient. And if you have to account for that in your calculations. Kelvin was never convinced of this. Never convinced of this. But that turns out to be the correct reason why Lord Kelvin was wrong. There was that first assumption about the Earth being solid, not the third assumption about there being no other source of energy. So the final piece to this is that because Perry, even though he was absolutely correct, never really had contemporary success in a, you know, in agreement, couldn't convince the scientific community, that delayed the discovery of plate tectonics for 70 years. Because they geologists kind of were dancing around the idea of plate tectonics. They knew that was something like that was happening, but everyone was like, no, but this, the crust is solid. It doesn't move. It can't happen. So it really took a lot to prove to the scientific community that over long periods of time, the Earth can flow. But they could have figured that out in 1895 or 96 if they had just believed Perry, who was correct.
Can you imagine where the plates would be today if we knew 70 years earlier? So, Steve, what about this, though? I mean, sure, all right, convection is much more critical than we thought. But isn't it the radiation, the release of heat, that allows the convection to continue for so long?
All right, this gets a bit complicated, but here it goes. So you're right that the part of the Earth's heat is radioactive decay heat rather than primordial heat, which is like, you know, the original heat of the collisions of everything that formed the Earth. But most of the heat in the core is probably primordial. And Kelvin's calculations weren't based on the total cooling of the Earth. They were based upon the cooling of the surface of the Earth, which is dominantly affected by convection, not by the radioactive decay heat at the surface. So, and I think we would still have a liquid mantle, even if it weren't for radioactive decay. But the bottom line is also that we don't completely know. We know that radioactivity is responsible for half of the heat leaving the surface of the Earth, but not. It's hard to say how much of the total internal heat energy of the Earth is primordial versus radioactive decay. But again, bottom line is that's not the key factor. The key factor is how quickly heat is getting from the core to the surface, and that's due to convection.
So then what would you say to, like, what somebody said to you, well, what would the Earth be like today if there was no radiation, no radioactivity?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I did not encounter that in, you know, my further research on this. So I vetted the hell out of this just because what I found. So first of all, almost every single resource I read repeats the radioactivity version of the story. Even authoritative sources, everyone has this wrong.
Why do you trust this source?
There was one source that said it was both. And then there was this is based upon a 2014 paper, Why Was Kelvin's Estimate of the Age of the Earth's Age Wrong? By Ian Lovett and M. Kasim Syed.
I love it.
So 2014, so we're our view is 7 years out of date, and then it was repeated in The American Scientist. Philip England, Peter Molnar, and Frank Richter wrote an article about this, but they relied heavily on the 2014 paper for a lot of the facts. So, yeah, I think it's pretty clear that this is the correct version of events, and but a lot of even authoritative sources are just telling the old story, simplified wrong version of the story. This gets to the fact that it's always more complicated than you think, which is why, right. Like, it's one thing, like, when we're talking about this on the show, obviously we research things as much as we can for the show, but, like, when you're writing something and you need, like, you need to verify specific facts with resources and everything, you know, you tend to dig a little bit deeper, and that's what I was doing in this case, and I dug deep enough to uncover this version of the story, which just blew me away. Like, holy shit, I had this wrong forever. Like, ever since I knew who Lord Kelvin was. Yeah.
Well, you and everybody else.
Yeah.
Or most everyone else.
But it's always like whenever so many people are wrong about something like this, like, we have to think, why is that the case? You know, and in this case, I think it was partly because it was just such a good story. And started going back to the scientists at the time, it just became a story that everybody told, too great an anecdote not to tell. And this is how it had 120 years of cultural inertia. Just incredible.
Yeah. I'm seeing here, somebody saying that despite its geological significance, the heat energy coming from Earth's interior is actually only 0.03% of Earth's total energy budget at the surface.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the interior has very little impact relatively to the exterior. So that's really the crux of this. Interesting.
I thought it was, I thought it was a fascinating story. Okay, let's get to our news items.
Show over?
Nope. We're gonna let's get to our news items. Kara, you're going to start us off with some kind of good news. I mean, well, the update is good news, but it's a really bad story when you dig down.
Yeah, it's a bummer that is... Yeah, okay. That's a good way to put it. So we remember, well, it comes from by many names, a Miracle Mineral Solution, MMS.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we've talked about that quite a bit on the show, but it's also known as, I have a few different things here. Here's one of them. According to the FDA, it has also been sold as Master Mineral Solution, Miracle Mineral Supplement, Chlorine Dioxide Protocol, Water Purification Solution, et cetera, et cetera. And this is one of these interesting things that just keeps on coming back.
Yeah. Thank you for pronouncing et cetera correctly.
You are welcome, sir. And I'll add an asterisk to that.
Oh, thanks again.
sure thing. So a Florida grand jury has just indicted a man named Mark Grennan, who is 62 years old, along with three of his sons, Jonathan, Jordan, and Joseph Grennan, who range between the age of 26 and 34. They're all from Bradenton. It might be Bradenton. I'm not sure. Florida.
Be, yeah.
They have been charged with violating court orders and fraudulently producing and selling more than $1 million worth of Miracle Mineral Solution.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Some really interesting stuff in this indictment if you dig through it. So first things first, not only have we known that Miracle Mineral Solution is bleach.
Yeah.
It's chlorine dioxide. So basically the way it comes is there's like a packet and then there's some sort of activator. They call it an activator, which is usually citric acid. And when combined, it produces bleach.
Industrial strength bleach.
Yeah. Like either the bleach that's used to clean stuff or to process fabrics, or it's the bleach that's used to purify water on like massive citywide scales, not like in your own body.
But Kara, I think like the really important question here is, does it taste good?
Probably not. But right, medicine's not supposed to taste good, Jay.
But how could it possibly? People drinking bleach, it blows my mind because at that point, when you're putting bleach in your mouth, this is like a caustic chemical.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. But you've taken
horrible medicine before, right? I don't think that's the leap.
What I don't get, though, is this. You have $1 million worth of this sold, and it's bleach. Why? The article I read, at least, said that no deaths, you know, were reported. But why?
No, they don't know that. They don't know that yet.
I mean, I would think it would be known, though. It wouldn't be hard to find.
The FDA has definitely received complaints of hospitalization, severe illness, and death. But they don't know if these specific dudes were responsible for specific deaths. Because here's the weird thing about Miracle Mineral Solution. Is this like a pyramid scheme or something? Because other people have been indicted on this before. So there's a Department of Justice press release from October 28th, 2015, where a man named Lewis Daniel Smith, 45-year-old, was indicted by the Eastern District of Washington. He was actually sentenced to serve 51 months in prison after selling Miracle Mineral Supplement. The individuals who have just been indicted in Florida, they own a church. Oh my gosh, this is the fun part.
Well, yeah, it's all...
Yeah, Genesis 2 Church of Health and Healing. And they have admitted that they only built the church in order to be able to peddle MMS. Yeah. To peddle MMS. They have said as much that this is a non-religious entity and it was a way to get around...
Yep, a lot of regulations.
Regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and here's the really scary part about this indictment, and this is kind of neither here nor there from a skeptic point of view, but I think it is important to mention, and this is all printed by the Southern District of Florida. You can like go to their website and read all about this indictment. These two of the individuals, the father and one of the sons, have been in prison now for a year because they were originally indicted on separate charges, and these new charges have been brought. And the reason that they've been held in prison for a full year, where the other two are you know, have not been brought to prison, they've only been brought up on charges, is because they violated a previous court order to stop production and stop selling. Not only did they violate it, but when they raided the Grennan's home, they found multiple loaded weapons. They found a shotgun that was like hidden in a violin case, like it was obviously meant to kind of be disguised. And they actually threatened the federal judge presiding over the case that should the government attempt to enforce the court order that tells them they can't distribute anymore, they would, quote, pick up guns and instigate a Waco.
Nice. Wow. Oh, my God.
So this is a really intense effort by this family who, this one family alone, a man and his three sons, when they raided their home, found dozens of chemical drums, you know, those big blue industrial drums containing nearly 10,000 pounds of sodium chloride powder, thousands of bottles of MMS ready to go, and other things that were used in the distribution. And they have found that they've already distributed tens of thousands of bottles of MMS through their, quote, church website, in which they ask for a, quote, donation that's a set price.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically, I'm selling you this stuff. And they claim that this stuff can cure, oh gosh, here's the really fun part.
Autism.
Yeah, autism.
Yeah. Alzheimer's, autism, brain cancer, multiple sclerosis, HIV and AIDS, and of course now COVID-19. And that's where this newest indictment came from. And I have a quote because I thought, why not play a little bit of name that logical fallacy while we're at this, Steve? So another individual who was not charged in this indictment, but who is part of the Genesis 2 church, he considers himself a founder and archbishop. So the one founder and archbishop that we have been discussing right now is Mark Grennan. He is now under, you know, indictment and being held in prison. But there's another dude named Jim Humble, former Scientologist, who claims that he is a billion-year-old god from the Andromeda Galaxy.
I remember him.
Sure. Yeah. And I think he's like hole up in Mexico right now. ABC, the local ABC News in 2016 did like a year-long investigation and interviewed these folks and figured out, you know, tried to figure out what is going on. And there was a conversation. They caught up with this guy in Guadalajara, and this is back in 2015, and said, the government says you're selling poison and that you're hurting people, that you're hurting children. There may have been deaths. What do you say? And Humble says it ain't true. You say it cures cancer and diabetes and autism. Yes, it cures all of those things. Do you really believe that?
Death does tend to cure everything. Yes.
Right. Yeah. Do you really believe that? Where did you study medicine? I didn't study medicine. I'm not a doctor and I'm proud of it. And then later.
And I'm proud of it.
Right. Well, later. Yeah. There you go. Steve.
Yes. Steve.
Turn that, twist that knife. Later, he put out a newsletter where he clarified his stance. And I think this is such a brilliant example of what we do here in the skeptic world. Here we go. Quote, there are certainly times I have said some things that I probably should have said differently. For lack of a better way to express things at the time or because others put words in my mouth, in the past I've stated that MMS cures most of all diseases. Today, I say that MMS cures nothing. MMS serves as a tool to kill pathogens and oxidize poisons in the body, which allows the body to heal the body. We live in a toxic world, and we are fortunate to have MMS as well as various other important health tools to combat the ill effects of poor foods and chemicals that make us sick. Where have we heard this before?
So somebody clued him into the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994, where you can't claim to cure a disease, but you can make structure function claims that are basically the same thing, but just with different language. So he's just shifting over to, you know, the quack-friendly language, which
Deshaies.
Is exactly why Deshaies is a terrible, terrible freaking law.
The nightmare that keeps on living.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the good news is that these dudes were brought up on charges anyway. They could be facing a lot of years for the harm and the, as we mentioned before, the potential death that they have brought to a lot of vulnerable and unsuspecting people who, of course, are going to have a difficult time separating, especially with that extra layer of healing, not from non-medical doctors, but from you know, a faith perspective.
Yep.
So you've got this additional layer of quackery and quackery added to within this religious sheen. And individuals who are desperate took them up on this, gave them lots of money, over $1 million. They shipped tens of thousands of bottles of this stuff. They were ready to ship tens of thousands of dollars more when they were raided. And now, luckily, they have been shut down. The question is, why does this bleach cure, which doesn't seem to have any sort of centralized movement behind it, keep right. popping up? Where is this whack-a-mole coming from? And why? I know. We talk about this all the time, that there are different kind of flavors of pseudoscience that tend to just recapitulate. But it's such an odd one, drinking bleach.
Yeah, why does it mm-hmm. persist? That's the thing I don't understand.
Yeah,
I feel like we saw our own previous president having like an epiphany on air, like in real time, where he's like, well, couldn't we just like drink the bleach? So obviously this is resonating with somebody or with a lot of people
yeah.
who are like trying to think about how the body works with minimal knowledge.
Well, Kara, I think that the one exception I'd say to that is that the notion that this is an effective treatment for autism has gotten into the online autism community, like the anti-science, you know, autism community. Ooh. So it is being promoted there. And so that is, you know,
and how much even more nefarious, because in those situations, think about how disgusting the ethics of feeding bleach to your children.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I think there's an element of like true believer in this, because to me, it's like, all right, I can kind of understand, you know, oh, I want to sell some snake oil with all these claims of cures and make a lot of money. But okay, I can kind of see that. I'm a greedy bastard and I want to make a lot of money and I'm going to rip off people. But to throw poison in there makes me think that maybe they kind of believe this, because why would any semi-rational scammer say, well, I'm going to scam people and poison them to death? I mean, why put those two together don't have to?
So what you're saying is like, why kill the consumer?
Right.
Like, because then they're not going to keep coming back.
Or and also, the law tends to look very negatively on scammers that murder, as opposed to apparently you can scam people with the right language for as much as you want and you're fine.
Yeah.
But throw a little murder in there and things get dicey.
Yeah, you're right. It is an interesting, like, are they, I mean, again, for all intents and purposes, it kind of doesn't matter. But are they swallowing what they're selling? It would be really interesting to see if they've taken Miracle, like if they're like, I take it and I swear by it.
I would strongly suspect that they just don't care.
Yeah.
They don't care if it's true or not. They don't care if it hurts people or not. It's working.
It's just got like a good markup.
It's their thing. Yeah, so that's it. They don't care.
Yeah. The individual who was sentenced back in 2015 in Washington, so this is a different guy, but who was peddling the same stuff, he was found to have all of this sodium chloride within his possession, and his MMS was a mixture of sodium chloride and water. He was found to have gotten his hands on all of it because he created a phony water purification and wastewater treatment business, and was able to get all these industrial chemicals and then, of course, sell them illegally.
Yep.
So it's pretty scary to see how these people are getting the chemicals, how they're combining them, how they're marketing, how they're packaging them. I mean, this is big stuff. And this is why we're seeing federal cases brought against them. This is going across state lines. There's, you know, fraud. There's, just risk to health and human
fraud
life.
Fraud is the only thing that explains it, frankly.
Yeah.
What else could it be?
Yeah, that's all. That's it. That's straight up fraud.
But those are the charges.
They're working the system, and it shows you how vulnerable the system is.
Mm-hmm.
You
know? Right.
These holes need to be plugged. All right, Jay, we lost a space hero today. Tell us about it.
Yeah, we lost Michael Collins today. So he was an American astronaut. He was 90. He did actually die today as we record this. And this is the part that you'll recognize. He flew in both the Gemini and Apollo programs.
Wow.
Yep. So he was born in Rome on October 31st, 1930. In 1952, he joined the Air Force. And by 1960, he became a test pilot. And, you know, of course, a lot of astronauts back in that day started out as test pilots. He was accepted into the astronaut program in 1963. And 3 years later, after he was accepted into the astronaut program, he piloted his first Gemini 10 mission.
How come whenever you watch old movies and you hear people talk about this, they call it Gemini?
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
I think NASA said it that way.
NASA said it that
NASA
way.
Yeah, NASA said Gemini.
I refuse to say it that way.
Okay.
Jump in Gemini.
He was accepted into the astronaut program in 1963. Three years later, in 1966, he piloted the Gemini 10 mission. And during that three-day mission, he and John Young obtained the highest orbit of that time. He also made two spacewalks where he rendezvoused with two uncrewed Agena target vehicles. Those are the vehicles that astronauts use to practice orbital space rendezvous and docking techniques. So they just send these vehicles up and they said, try to connect to that. Like, try to dock with it. Try to spin things around, you know, try to change your orientation. And they just learned a lot with those vehicles, which I thought was really cool. And he was one of the people who did a lot of work on that. He worked with the engineers, with NASA engineers, on developing the pressure suits for spacewalks. And at the time, he was considered one of the leading authorities on the subject, which I found to be amazing. You know, because when they were bringing astronauts into the astronaut program back then, they would immediately assign them to do something. Like, you know, you have to liaise with these engineers and help them blah, 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 you know, do this, that, and the other thing. Those astronauts were pretty damn key in developing a lot of the technology that happened. You know, they weren't, most of them, if not all of them, were not actually engineers, but they became key players in the development of all that stuff. So there were three astronauts going to the most famous mission of all, the three astronauts on the Apollo mission. This was Apollo 11. This was the first moon landing. And Commander Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins were the three people on there. So there you go. So Michael Collins was the third guy. He was the other guy. Now, what was his job? While Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed and walked around on the moon, Michael Collins stayed in the command module and he waited for them to return. And, you know, it becomes very unromantic once the people that are going to the moon leave, because, you know, what's happening on the command module, you know?
You know, just all the science and comms and important stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it is important because first and foremost, there has to be someone for them to go back to. And, you know, that ship needed to be maintained and, you know, they needed to keep in touch with NASA. But there's a few things about this that I think you'll find interesting. So while Neil and Buzz stayed on the moon, they were down there for 8 days. Michael Collins was alone in orbit around the moon, a quarter of a million miles from Earth, alone. You know what I mean? And here's the thing. He wasn't actually in constant radio communication with NASA because of the position and the orbit and everything. He was only getting spotty connections because, you know, it has to be line of sight, right? As soon as you can't see the Earth, you basically can't broadcast at that time. You couldn't broadcast to get to them. So he was alone, and that's scary. And he did it for 8 days. And more interestingly, he wrote in his book that he was terrified to have to return back to Earth by himself due to some catastrophe on the moon, which, right? And it wasn't unlikely. It was not an unlikely occurrence.
No, it wasn't.
The hardest part for him was the 3.5-hour trip that the lunar lander had to take from the moon to get back to the command module. So they took off from the moon's surface. 3.5 hours later, they show up. And during those 3.5 hours, that's when he shit a brick. Because he just was like, what's going to happen to them? Are they actually going to come back? And he freaked out about that thought, you know, way ahead of the mission. You know, way before he went into space, he was like, oh my God, what if they don't come back? You know, so of course, it's legitimately a scary thing. And I like this humanizing version of an astronaut. You know, he was a real guy. He was cool as a cucumber. You know, he is legitimately one of the reasons why the word cool means what it does mean. You know, like, he was cool. He was calm, collected, very intelligent. But, you know, there was a human being sitting inside there, and he did get scared because of what was happening. I just like that connection, you know. It wasn't like, you know, they're not androids. They're actually having to deal with themselves as well. So all three of them were awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. This is the highest honor a civilian can receive in the United States. And I do love that, you know, as much as a lot of the astronauts didn't look at themselves as heroes, they were heroes. So Michael Collins wrote a lot of books, several books after his career as an astronaut. First, he went on to become the founding director of the National Air and Space Museum. He oversaw its actual opening, you know, among other duties that he held. But he got into writing books. And he wrote a book called Carrying the Fire, another one called Flying to the Moon and Other Strange Places, another one called Mission to Mars. I strongly recommend reading the book Carrying the Fire, because that book was described as being incredibly accurate to the experience of flying to the moon and of being an astronaut. And he does express, you know, the pressure and the strain and, you know, the fortitude that they have to, they have to use in order to do this. It's not an easy thing to do. And his book is very much lauded as something that really gets into the emotional parts of it, which I already ordered the book, today, because I just wanted to read more about that. He always and often strongly advocated for space exploration. He really believes that it's a key element to human nature and that we need to exercise that because it brings out the best in people and it pushes humanity forward in a positive direction. So, you know, Michael Collins, the guy that was back on the command module while something amazing was happening at on the moon's surface below, you know, maybe it was the hardest of the three tasks, you know, the three positions on there. And I give this man a lot of respect and I really appreciate what he did. And, you know, he spent his entire life continuing to be involved in space and the exploration of space, which is one of my biggest, you know, passions in my life. So, you know, Michael Collins, what a cool guy. You know, he was there from the beginning. He saw it all. He experienced that whole era. You know, he lived it. And if there ever was a hero, he's one of them.
Yeah, I learned a couple of interesting little tidbits when I was, you know, reading about him today. One was that, you know, he was offered the command of Apollo 17, which means he could have gone to the surface of the moon. But he decided to retire from NASA before that because he figured that he did it. It was done.
You know, it wasn't just that, Steve. You want to know why else he did that?
Yeah, I know. The other thing is that he really didn't want the limelight. You know, he liked the fact that he was the least famous of the three Apollo 11 astronauts. And in fact, you know, it kind of gave him the freedom to go on and have a very productive, fulfilling life. Mm-hmm. And whereas Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin had to deal with, you know, the fame of being the first two guys on the moon. And they had a lot of problems, you know. So, and he did, I got that.
I wonder if he knew that going in, that that's how it would be when it was decided, like, you're going to stay behind.
I think so. He did not want to be a celebrity. He did not want to be a celebrity.
And he also said that he wanted the second mission was his last mission, and largely because he wanted to have that time with his family. He said, you know, preparing for a mission like that and then doing the mission.
Yeah.
You know, you basically don't exist to your family. You are training all the time. Right. And then the physical aspect of it was grueling. And he just wanted to be with his family. And I appreciate and respect that. You know, I'm the same way. I would be the same way.
Yeah, it would have been a big commitment, 2-3 years, you know, of not just the mission, but of training. And he figured he did it already. You know, didn't want to do it again.
Go back and look at some pictures and you'll get a sense of what it was like. I mean, if you're young and you've never really looked into that era of US history and of NASA history, it is fascinating.
You know, and horrifying.
It was
those little tin boxes. Like, no, thank you. There's some crazy stories about just like puking all over the place, about just being like violently ill, just losing consciousness. It was a weird time.
That's why, like, there's something romantic about the Apollo program, because it was like going to the moon with 1960s technology.
As rough as it gets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they did it.
I know. Now, they knew they were being bathed with radiation during this whole time, but considered it an acceptable, a tolerant
level. It was acceptable amounts, but they just had to hope that they didn't get hit with a CME or something during their mission.
Yeah, that could have happened. Yeah. But for a brief duration, you're okay. But, you know, more than a few days or whatever, it could get nasty. Yep. So
They knew they were guinea pigs. I mean, they were willing to take on the risk. That's bravery that you were talking about. Being a hero.
He was 90. Buzz Aldrin is 90 and still alive. And, you know, Neil Armstrong died just a couple of years ago. They all lived into their old age.
Yep. Steve is saying there's a correlation with long life and traveling to space.
That's science.
Yeah, do that. Go into outer space and get radiation and drink some bleach and you're good, man.
All right, Bob, keeping with the space theme, you're going to tell us about a new study looking at the plausibility of microbial life on Mars.
Yeah, Mars in the news again this week. A new research on meteorites from Mars show that not only might life have existed eons ago on the red planet, but it still might be there right now. right now, right now.
Look behind you.
This study was published in the journal Astrobiology. And for me, I don't know about you guys, this brings Mars kind of right back into the game of life in our solar system. Because for a while, of course, it was the only game in town, right? Except for Earth, of course, duh. Mars was thought to have had life early in its career for many reasons. but especially since it clearly had water on it, right? You could see it. Yes, this had water. It was flowing water at some point. And then we had that false positive evidence for life, like microbial life years ago. Remember that? And that was a big psych, which was very disappointing because for a little while there, I was convinced, yes, we found microbial, you know, there was microbial life on Mars. And then to have that pulled away really sucked. Plus there's the fact that we've actually been on the planet for years and there's like no solid evidence and we've been there for years. So it's kind of like, yeah, you know, I didn't really, you know, it wasn't like, for me, it wasn't like, oh, there's life on Mars. We're going to find something on Mars, even if it's ancient, fossilized. Then, of course, we had Europa and Enceladus and other bodies that seemed to like almost a no-brainer that the environments are so perfect for some type of microbial life that it's a pretty decent bet that it's probably there. So that kind of, in terms of life in the solar system, that's what I was thinking, Europa and then Enceladus and some others. But then now this latest evidence brings Mars kind of like right back up with with Europa and Enceladus in my book anyway, because it's not just about the water and, that was and is on Mars. That's always been encouraging. But these latest findings really bolster the case, not only for ancient life, but current life on Mars. And that's amazingly exciting. And it's all because of meteorites. Now, some people might think, well, what does meteorites have to do with Mars? Luckily we don't need to go on a sampling mission of Mars to get Mars rocks back here on Earth because there were historically huge impacts on Mars eons ago, millions of years ago. And that did all the work for us by basically throwing chunks of rock right at us. Here you go. Here's some good samples of Mars right for you, right for your scientists. So the researchers examined these rocks in detail. And the bottom line, I'll just throw the bottom line at you, is that these Martian rocks, if they were in contact with water for any period of time, they would chemically produce the energy that microbial-like communities could use to thrive. The rock is actually would be exquisite for that. So now this is because – we'll take another layer deeper into this onion here. And that's because of processes like radiolysis, which is fascinating. I wasn't too familiar with it.
Ooh, that's a cool word.
Yeah. Radiolysis is the breaking apart of molecules by ionizing radiation. That's kind of like – in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. So, like what your cell phone doesn't do to you.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So if water is in consistent contact with rocks that contains elements like uranium or thorium or potassium, the following happens. One, water separates into hydrogen and oxygen, splits them apart. Huge. Then two, the now free hydrogen is essentially dissolved into the water that's there, right? The oxygen gets absorbed into other minerals like pyrite, which forms these sulfate minerals. Now, microbes, if they exist, you know, assuming that they already exist, which is a big if, of course, microbes can then eat the hydrogen like Twinkies. Just eat the hydrogen. And I apologize for the Twinkie comment because I had my first Twinkie in about a decade yesterday.
It was on the shelf all this time.
I'm still thinking about it.
They're still really good, aren't they?
So,
I had one
so
recently
good.
And I was like, so it's just as I remember.
Yeah, right? Ah, delicious.
So, well, they went out of business for a bit and then came
I'm
back.
Glad they came back.
That's another story.
So the microbes would eat the hydrogen Twinkies, and the oxygen and the sulfates are then used to burn the hydrogen Twinkie fuel. Right? So that's what could happen. Now, most of the Martian meteorites that they looked at had plenty of the elements that they need to support microbial life. And if you took those Martian rocks that we have and buried them a few kilometers under the ground here on Earth, the microbes down there right now would live on those Martian Twinkies without a second thought. It would be just, it would make wonderful fuel for them. And so you may be saying, Bob, what microbes are you talking about kilometers under the ground? Well, I'm glad you asked. I hadn't read about this in quite a while, but this actually exists. It's called the deep biosphere. It's a little bit of an aside, Steve. Please don't delete me. So this is 70% of the world's bacteria and archaea probably exist several kilometers under the ground right now under our feet. It's one of the biggest and least understood ecosystems on the planet. calculations and models show that 6 times 10 to the 29 cells could be down there. Huge, gargantuan. And Mars could potentially have a similar ecosystem inside. So that, you know, when you compare those two, it's pretty dramatic. No, of course, no guarantees, but it seems like everything that's needed could be there, just like in Enceladus in Europa. Study lead Jesse Tarnas is a postdoc researcher at JPL, NASA's JPL, said, "We don't know whether life ever got started beneath the surface of Mars, but if it did, we think there would be ample energy there to sustain it right up to today." Wow. So where do we go? Where do we go from here? In the future, obviously we have to dig, right? We got to go down. But fortunately, we don't need these big rigs like they have the oil drills in Texas. We don't need the big boys to do that. It seems like they've made some advances in small drill probes that could do the job of digging deep on Mars to look for microbes. So that's awesome. And then I got a quote here from Jack Mustard of the University of Toronto. He said, "The subsurface is one of the frontiers of Mars exploration. We've investigated the atmosphere, mapped the surface with different wavelengths of light, and landed on the surface in a half a dozen places. And that work continues to tell us so much about the planet's past. But if we want to think about the possibility of present-day life, the subsurface is absolutely going to be where the action is." So it's really encouraging to think that not only that, oh yeah, maybe we'll find some fossilized life, maybe, or maybe probably not even the life itself, but like what they left behind that fossilized. But there are some serious scientists who think that they could, that these microbes or whatever could exist. And that would be the discovery of the millennia, I would say. That would put that up there with almost any scientific discovery.
Yeah, anything that makes it more likely for there to be life on Mars. But as soon as we discover life on Mars, man, then we got a huge dilemma in our hands. Like, do we have to, like, leave Mars alone now?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I mean, yeah, maybe, I don't know what the result would be. But the thing is, how could that not intensify study instead of it causing us to slack off?
We need a prime directive on some level.
Or maybe we could limit research to certain areas, or make extra, you know, precautions not to contaminate it. You know, whatever we sent there, you know, we just make sure that there's not one microbe. I don't know. But yeah.
Well, we've already kind of violated that.
Oh, right? Yeah. Totally.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But that would be a good problem to have.
All right, guys, I'm just going to do a quick news item myself today. This is about political polarization. And what's interesting about this is a recent study looking at this is I think it's always good to pay attention when there's a disconnect between what people believe and reality, right? And whenever you come across that, there's a difference between what you think and what in reality, you should pay attention to that and try to make a correction. That's basically the whole concept of cognitive biases. So this is an interesting cognitive bias, a paper looking at different political points of view and what people think about what the other side believes, right? And so what it showed is pretty much across the board, people overestimate how radical, extreme, and unreasonable the other side is.
Yeah, they want to make boogeymen out of other people.
Yeah, like there's a desire for simplicity, for moral clarity. And this is, you know, this is in line with prior research, which shows basically the same thing. But let me give you an example. So, for example, if you ask, like, if you ask Democrats how many Republicans think that, like, gun safety is a good thing, there's a disconnect between what the Democrats believe about the Republicans and what the Republicans actually believe. Mm-hmm. And if you ask Republicans, like, about, like, how many Democrats would endorse a statement, like, endorsing free speech, they, again, grossly overestimate how extreme the other side's position is. And across the board, it's about by 25%, you know, across groups, across questions, on average. If you're thinking, like, what percentage of Republicans would you say believe this? What percentage of Democrats would you say believe this? We tend to overestimate what the percentage of the other side that would take the more extreme position by about 25%.
Think that's because we associate sort of the norm with the loud but vocal, or sorry, with the vocal but not typical minority?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a reporting bias on this. And of course, the media loves to emphasize issues about which people disagree and about which there is conflict and polarization, and not so much issues where there's common ground and where there's less disagreement. So I think there's also a journalism bias here.
Right. And they don't tell the stories about the moderate view. They tell the stories about the most extreme version of that view.
Right.
And also, and that even what I consider to be some of the better news outlets, they fall so depressingly into this pattern. It's like, look, we found somebody to express the extreme view. Let's talk to them. You know,
Here's your typical.
There's a formula where you basically showcase, cherry pick, go out of your way to find the polarization.
It's a form of sensationalism.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's some more interesting tidbits in here. So one is they looked at the effect of where do you get your news. Right. Mm-hmm. It turns out that this is not surprising. The more partisan your primary source of news, the greater the disconnect between what you think and reality about political.
It kind of reinforces. So your
estimation of political polarization is greater. There were actually three news networks that decreased the magnitude of the disconnect, and that was NBC, CBS, and ABC, the traditional.
Interesting.
Yeah, the traditional networks.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, because they have they've got an audience of people from all different sides of the aisle.
Yeah.
They've been around longer.
They
also, I think, have kind of the journalistic ethic that, you're right, that goes back a long time.
Yeah, and I don't know if it has to do with like before versus after the fairness doctrine. Not that that was perfect, but you know, just that prior to that, you know, TV news outlets had to be balanced, you know, and after that they didn't. So here's one question. Let me just ask you this. So Kara, what percentage of Republicans, and try to really answer the question seriously, what percentage of Republicans would you say would endorse the statement, racism is still a problem in America?
Oh, I think a large percentage of them would endorse that. Maybe like 75%.
Good. Yeah. 78%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But most Democrats estimated it. But the average less estimate among Democrats was 50%.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by that.
Because
even I think about like my own father, and he would endorse that. His views on racism, I highly disagree with, but he would still endorse that statement.
All right. So Jay, what percentage of Democrats would endorse the statement, law-abiding citizens should have the right to bear arms?
That's a good question. Probably 50%.
70%.
Wow.
There you go.
Yeah, so you had it. Yeah, 70%.
So even, that's interesting.
The average response, though, was 46%, a 24% drop, disconnect with reality there. So that's about 25% is sort of the average there. So it's interesting, you know. So, and again, I like to broaden this to, we tend to do this generally, you know, to violate the principle of charity. We form these narratives and then we sort of pigeonhole and make this cardboard image of the quote unquote other side. And we tend to overestimate our differences and underestimate our common ground. But also it shows that where you get your news content, if you get it from like Breitbart News, that dramatically increases your disconnect from reality.
Sure.
But also, if you share political news on social media, that was associated with an increased disconnect from reality as well. So it's not just traditional media.
Steve, it's so interesting that you mentioned, sorry to interject, this idea of the principle of charity that we talk about a lot on the show, you know, from a kind of cognitive bias perspective and from a how do we find common ground perspective, especially when we're dealing with friends or relatives who believe in conspiracy theories or yada yada. And it's so interesting because in my therapeutic approach recently, I've been utilizing the concept of the principle of charity as like an empathy training exercise and imploring sometimes, you know, patients, or even I do this in my daily life with myself, with my friends, to almost come up with an absurdly charitable explanation for somebody's behavior before acting, like almost go to an extreme. Like that person didn't not take out the trash because they were trying to punish you by leaving it for you, but maybe they didn't take out the trash because they just found out that their father was in the hospital and had to run out the door, you know? And I find that when you do these mental exercises, you actually become more empathic. Mm-hmm. You actually over time stop stop being so irritated with the way other people act towards you.
That's a good thing. But the other thing is, even if you just take a moderately charitable view, that's a better first approximation of what's likely to be true. It's just
for sure. We bias uncharitably because we bias totally. We're the actor of our own play, and everybody's doing stuff to us.
That's right.
So I came up with a list of recommendations for how we can to compensate for this uncharitable bias that that we have. So one, of course, is just suggested by the data in this study. Try to get your news from multiple sources and from the least biased sources you could find. Mm-hmm. It's hard, and it feels good to get news from a source that reinforces your biases, but challenge yourself. Seek out different perspectives. Don't just, we see this all the time. Don't just assume that the first thing you hear is correct or the thing that you want to be true is correct. Actually try to ask the question, who disagrees with this position? Why do they disagree with this position? What other information is there out there? Absolutely apply the principle of charity. It's a good starting assumption. It is more likely to be true as a starting assumption than an uncharitable starting point. Because I think the thing is, we not only do we overestimate polarization, we underestimate common ground. And when people actually talk to each other, you realize we kind of all want the same thing, right? We all want justice, security, liberty, fairness. But we just have different priorities, maybe different experiences, different, belief systems. But generally speaking, we're all people. We want the same thing. And the thing is, everyone thinks they're right. Pretty much. Obviously, there's the 1% of psychopaths out there, but we got to put them aside. For the non-psychopathic, individuals, most people think that they're on the... Even like we were watching that QAnon documentary, the people who believe in the worst, most absurd QAnon conspiracy theories, they think they're the good guys.
Oh, they passionately believe it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I think of that all the time. They're as convinced as we are.
And they are working to dismantle a global cabal of pedophiles. Like they see this as like God's work.
Exactly. So the other thing is, especially like on social media and comment section, very simple, listen. Don't just talk at somebody and use them as a representative of the other side. That's like the thing that irritates me the most, that when people do that to me, they start like criticizing a position I never took and often is directly contradicted by stuff I just wrote because they're clearly arguing against a something that's in their head. They have this straw man in their head, and once you're on the other side, they argue against that straw man. But they think that's your position because they're not listening to what you're saying. Everything is going through this filter. But again, we all do this to some degree, so just don't do that. Don't be that person. Listen to what the other person's actually saying, and if you be charitable in interpreting what they're saying, and if you don't understand, ask for clarification, saying, so are you saying this? Is this a fair representation of your position? Try to get to the fairest representation possible that they will endorse, and then engage with that. That's called engaging. If you want to engage with me on any topic, I'm happy to do that, especially if you disagree with me. That's the most interesting thing. But if you want to just talk at me and without listening to what I'm saying, I'm not interested in that. That's not constructive. That's not going to get us anywhere. Don't assume bad faith. Again, that's generally going to be incorrect. If you leap to a bad faith assumption, not to say that there aren't bad faith actors out there, there are. But if you leap to that assumption, first of all, it's usually self-serving. You're just reinforcing your own position. It's usually a way of dismissing points on the other side. And it's usually not true. I could tell you 100% of the bad faith accusations that are pointed at me are not true. I am not a shill for Big Pharma.
What?
Yeah, right.
But the thing is, but we do it as well. We think, oh, this guy's a con artist or this person's whatever. Maybe they are, but don't assume it. Don't assume it. Assume good faith until somebody proves they have bad faith. That's a much better approach. It also puts you on firmer ground.
Sure.
Because first of all, if you assume it and you're wrong, then you're the asshole.
Yeah.
And if you assume it, and even if you're right, it's still an assumption. you still haven't justified it. It's like a scientist just asserting the correct answer. That's not worth anything. You have to prove the correct answer. So it's the same thing. Assume that somebody's acting in faith until they prove that they're not. And then, of course, we have to just always apply critical thinking, which is a huge topic, but that has to be in there as well. So the good news is, well, yes, this is one more of many biases we have, and this can be a particularly bad one. It's totally fixable with some very simple behaviors that are going to make you what you think and believe closer to reality. And that's a good thing.
That's my daily life, Steve.
Yeah. Well, you live on Facebook, Jay.
Get out.
All right. Evan, I understand the cicadas are coming back.
Yes, they are. As scheduled, as planned. Well, let's see. The last time this particular brood was around, it was 2004. Do we remember 2004, everyone?
Absolutely.
Oh, it was so long ago.
It was 17 years ago.
Yeah, 17 years ago. That's correct. You know, Facebook, as long as we were talking about that, Facebook was hit the scene in 2004. Skype, Jay. Skype hit the scene.
Remember Skype?
remember when it was good? when it actually worked the way it was supposed to?
When it looked like it worked, too.
How about those one megapixel cameras on your cell phones? Not even smartphones. There were no smartphones. One megapixel cell phone. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And BroodX. Yep. BroodX 2004. X meaning 10. Brood 10. Roman numeral X. Yep. So in the coming weeks from right now, billions, and I've seen numbers actually estimating into the trillions, perhaps.
What?
Of cicadas. Now, I call them cicadas. I've heard them called cicadas.
Cicadas.
Right.
tomato. I call them Gemini.
Billions of these cicadas, they will emerge, spanning a dozen U.S. states or so, from New York all the way out west to Illinois, as far south as Georgia. But the hot spots will be Indiana, Ohio, Tennessee, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. So geographically, Brood X is the largest of all the 17-year cicadas, of all the periodical cicadas. And there's several of these groups, and you can find neat maps and things online to show you exactly where they are and which brood and where they pop up. How about this for a stat? Up to 1.5 million cicadas from Brood X will pop up per acre in certain regions of those states.
Jeez.
1 acre, yeah. 1.5 million of them. Oh, boy.
Whoa.
All right. Scientific name, Cicadidae. They are invertebrates, and they are herbivores. Yep. They suck the sap out of the roots of the trees while living 1 to 2 feet under the ground. Now, what do you think their group name is? You know, like a murder of crows. What do you think cicadas?
Oh, it's probably something to do with the sound they make.
Or a plague is taken.
Yes,
plague.
Bob. Well, it's one of the two. It's a plague of cicadas.
Oh, so nice. Locusts and cicadas both plague.
And or you could say a cloud of cicadas. I like that one, too. I like cloud more than plague because it's really not a plague.
I wanted it to be like a rattle of cicadas. They're so loud.
It's about the loud, right? Sound-producing insects. Yep. We have two pairs of membranous wings, prominent compound eyes, and three simple eyes. And loud, Kara, that is the point. The male cicadas produce loud noises by vibrating those timbales or membranes near the base of their abdomen. Now, how loud? How loud do they get?
Loud.
Yeah. Try a Harley Davidson motorcycle or your neighbor's lawnmower revving up. They've been measured 100 decibels of noise when they get cranking. That is loud.
Wow.
Those are the males making those noise, getting ready for the breeding. Yeah. For the frenzy, I believe they call it.
Yeah. But how many of them, right? If the more there are, the one they the louder.
Well, I mean, right. In some cases, you've got 1.5 million in an acre, in a square acre.
Okay, so at that density, though.
At that density, it gets way up
there.
It's
deafening.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It interferes with other things going on in the environment as far as noise considerations go.
We did this really cool cicada thing at a museum in Staten Island, and they taught me how to like do this thing with my hand to make it look like a female cicada. Oh. And then you would hold the male cicada and it would just start doing that mating call.
Oh, seriously.
And trying to like mate with your fingers.
Tricking it.
Wait, you could did get this it. By choice?
Yeah, because we were in a group and I wanted to learn. But they're so cool. They're so big. I mean, gosh, they're big and they're so loud.
I still want to eat one.
Yeah,
you totally you could. Can. There's billions of them.
I don't know if I even you. Know you two anymore. You want to have sex with one and Steve wants to eat one.
Here's my hand.
Well, eating them would probably be a little easier.
Yeah, I think.
And they have cookbooks about cicadas. In fact, one that came out in the last Brood X in 2004, it was called Cicadalicious. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Cookbook focused on eating, how to prepare cicadas for consumption. Now, nice when dipped in chocolate, Bob, and some people, stir fry, pizza, banana bread, rhubarb
pie. I would try
pie.
It, but with chocolate, oh, boy.
I
got a question.
Yeah.
Now, how positive are they that this is going to happen? Because the last thing I remember about these guys is that there was supposed to be a big one like 3 or 4 years ago, and then I heard nothing about it. Didn't see one. Heard lots of disappointment. So how do we even know this is going to happen?
Based on what? The pattern of history?
Well, I mean, the prediction, in my estimation, the prediction failed 4 or 5 years ago.
Well, is that a regional bias, Bob? I mean, because it didn't, it was supposed to have happened here in Connecticut, and it didn't happen to the extent that it was hyped up.
Yeah, was it a function of there weren't as many as people expected, or did they come late?
No, there just weren't as many.
Yeah, there weren't as many. It wasn't the event, the grand
event. Right, it's
event
not like the cicadas aren't coming.
Right, that's correct. Now, how much the changing environment and climate change is having an impact on these things, I think they're still looking into this to try to figure it out. You can't throw, you have to be able to consider that, though, as part of it. What they can tell you is that when the soil temperature reaches 64 degrees Fahrenheit, that's when they will start to emerge. And around these regions of the country, that will happen in the next couple of weeks, early to middle of May.
Wow.
That's
across,
so cool.
Across those
I heard some of them have been detected, having created their like exit tunnels, getting ready.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're really getting ready, like they can anticipate it.
Yep, they can. Oh, one more point about eating them, though, because they do warn, and I saw this in a few different places, so a few warnings. If you are going to collect them in the wild, be careful of a couple things. Some of them have elevated levels of mercury. So you have to, deal with that. If you're going to pick them up off your backyard, make sure you're not pouring a lot of pesticides and other weed control and other things into that immediate area. So they recommend don't pull them from those areas that have those kinds of chemicals in the soil. And if you have allergic reactions, especially for people who have shellfish allergies, probably not a good idea. You should avoid those. So they do.
Right.
Come
so don't them. Have sex with them if you're shellfish allergy.
that's just for you, Jay. That's right. The cicadas won't hurt you. They don't sting. They're not venomous. They do get a bad rap because of the biblical plague of locusts, right? And they kind of look like locusts, but they're not locusts. So you don't have to fear them. And for the most part, you leave them be. Let them be. Unless you're going to collect some to eat them, fine. Be careful about that. But they're harmless to you. They won't wipe out your gardens or your fields. Again, they suck on the roots underground while they're alive, and then they come out. They're going to have their frenzy for a few weeks. The females of the species will lay their eggs. A single female can lay up to 600 eggs. Then they will die, but the offspring will go back down to the ground and to wait for the next 17 years.
Yeah, let them have their spring break, you guys.
Now, do you know what
this is like? They live their whole lives for this sex frenzy.
They do. Yep.
The festival.
And I'll wrap up with this. Cicadas have one defense against predators.
Yes, I love this. This is my favorite part.
Yep. They overwhelm their predators by copulating, by making so many of them that the animals and other creatures that eat them become too full to continue to eat them. They call this technique predator satiation.
Satiation. I love it. That's such that's their survival strategy. Make so many, fill all the bellies of all the predators, and then have a bunch left over that can't possibly be eaten, and they have sex and have the good times.
Yep.
That's nuts.
Overwhelm
that
the
is
system.
Literally, I've never heard that. I can't believe I haven't heard that before. And it blows my mind that, that's their survival strategy.
It's so cool.
Yeah, because they came out a little bit at a time, then they'd all be eaten.
Right.
They come out all at once. So even if every animal eats their full, there's still a lot of them left over.
It's like their version of, you know, of making like, you know, like 50 turtle eggs. You know, you know most of them's going to get eaten by those damn birds on the beaches.
Yeah, so you got to, right.
You know, you got to.
So instead, we'll make a trillion.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. There is definitely a noise in this thing that reminds me of a video game from the 80s.
Remember those?
What is this?
What it reminded me of, I know this isn't correct. When I was a boy, you would have these toy guns that would have a trigger and it would spin a wheel that would make a cranking kind of noise. And the more you cranked it, like it revved up and spun down.
It made sparks, right?
Yeah, or made sparks or something like that. It reminded me a little of that, even though I know that's not the answer. That's what it reminded me of.
Jay, it reminded me of that toy. Remember the kids? I've seen what the kids have had it. I don't forget where I saw it, but it's basically like this elevated track where this vehicle would slide down the track, and then when it hit the bottom, it would it had a cranking mechanism that would rise it up to give it, you know, to give it some potential energy again, so then it could then ride the track down.
That's not it. And you're not even close. But let me go forward here. So Richard Smith wrote in and said, since Steve brought up Subnautica, I'll say that this week's noisy is a school of cuttlefish. He said, why they're on a metal turning lathe, though I couldn't say.
I was going to say. I think his guess is
metal turning lathe. It is not cuttlefish on or using or in a metal turning lathe shop drinking coffee. But yeah, okay, I could see why you'd say a metal turning lathe, but there is other noises going on in here that to me would definitely not come from a lathe like that. Casey Ritchie, he says, hey, job. I think that's Jay and Bob combined.
I like it.
I'm probably wrong because this seems too easy, but this sound definitely reminded me of the sound of a drill the dentist uses on cavities. All right, now I was going to play the sound of that and I decided not to.
Yeah.
You didn't want to have to do a trigger warning?
Yeah, because it was a triggery. I listened to it and I was kind of like, you know, like,
do you think
yeah.
So it triggered you. It sounded the same to hear the drill. Because for me, I think the reason it's so triggering is because it's in your head.
Yes, yes. It's your head's vibrating. And a comedian I no longer will acknowledge, but he once said, you see and smell smoke coming out of your mouth.
Smoke. It's your tooth
dust. It's true.
Your
mouth is on fire. All right. Not a dentist drill, but thank you for the email. Joshua Gillespie. He said, hi, Majay. Majay, I don't even know what this means anymore.
Oh, boy. This is a thing now.
I know. Is it a dolphin? Keep up the good work, Joshua.
I love it. Just, is it a dolphin?
So, Majoshua, I don't know.
Majoshua.
I don't know if it's a dolphin or not, but I'm pretty sure it isn't. How about that? That's the answer. Actually, it's not a dolphin. When would a dolphin make noises like that? What, I don't know. Maybe when they're having sex with a goddamn cicada? I don't know. Stephen Hunter wrote in, Jay, my guest this week, a recording of the internal robotics of an android life form, just as Captain Kirk confuses it with logic in order to make it explode. Yeah, that was what little girls are made of, I think, the episode from original series Star Trek. Very funny. They actually use bad logic to make logical beings lose their mind. And Spock helped them. It was great. You got to watch it.
Wait, what little girls are made of?
I think that was the episode.
I don't recall that being an episode title.
No, yeah, it was.
Little girls are made of.
No, I think you're thinking of like I Mud, Jay.
I thought it was
I Mud. Okay. Yeah. All right, moving on. Colin von Huring. Colin von Huring actually won. And I had to email him to say, dude, is it okay if I use your name? And he's like, okay, oh my God, yeah, of course. So he sends me his name. So he said, hello, Jay, if that's your real name. See, now he is a name thing on this episode. Yeah. I don't get what's happening. They're all talking behind my back. I know who this noisy. Now, he actually wrote that. I know who this noisy. It's a laser etcher, and it sounds like it's making something that includes a circular pattern. Oh my God, he nailed it. He nailed it. So, okay. This is a laser etching device. You know, I did this a few years ago, and this one blows it away. This noise, the noise that this thing makes. So if you watch the video of this, I think it's printing police badges, and it is like doing a lot of things at the same time. But that noise that we're hearing, I'm pretty sure, is the vaporization of the metal. It's the heating and vaporizing of the metal that's happening. You're not hearing the production of the laser itself. I'm pretty sure. Very cool. Very, very wide array of noises happening. Let me just play it back real quick. Right, burning. It's burning the metal. Just very cool. Very, very cool that we can do things like that with light. So, good job. I got a lot of guesses. A lot of people ended up guessing this correctly. That came, you know, the emails came in like, you know, 4 or 5 days later. But still, send those guesses because I learn a lot and I also get to read a lot of funny emails. So I appreciate that. I have a new sound for this week, and here it is. So if you think you know what this noisy is, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. And don't forget, if you heard something cool, send it to that address as well. You can attach things to that email. You know, it's just a regular email address. So you don't have to go through the website. If you want to send me an attachment, you send it to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, brother. One email. This comes from Mattias, who writes, I had a conversation with a friend recently who claimed that humans aren't the most intelligent species on the planet because we are destroying our own habitat and threatening the existence of her own species with, for example, climate change, pollution, wars, and nuclear weapons. How can a species be seen as intelligent if they are ruining things for themselves to such an extent? The second interesting point is that she argues that dolphins are also intelligent but don't have these destructive tendencies and therefore could be seen as more intelligent than humans. In reply, I said that dolphins haven't created the technology that we have. She then said that development of technology is only our way of defining intelligence since technology is valued by us humans. Of course, we are going to equate technology with intelligence. If dolphins came up with their definition of intelligence, humans would be the less intelligent ones according to that definition. I found myself having a surprisingly hard time arguing against her points, but have a feeling that there is some faulty reasoning going on. I would love to hear your take on this. Thanks for the great show. That's an interesting question. I do think that your friend is kind of committing the same fallacy that she's accusing others of committing. So we can't. Yes, there is no one completely objective operational definition of intelligence. You have a vague definition of intelligence, sort of cognitive power to do something, you know, but. There are different ways to measure it. There are different kinds of intelligence. Like you might argue that the human species is certainly very clever and good at problem solving and good at engineering, but maybe not quite so wise. You know, that doesn't mean we're not intelligent. Just they're completely different things. I think so. The fallacy is trying to use intelligence as if it's one thing. Similarly,
and also
like,
to talk about it's a construct.
Yeah.
We developed the idea of intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and then we operationally defined it and we use tests to look for it, but they all require a human level mastery of language.
Yeah. Right.
So you can't even test. We can do things like the mirror test, but that shows cognitive capability, but I wouldn't call that intelligence per se. It's dolphin intelligence.
Yeah, well, dolphins are good at some things. They have a lot of brain processing power for echolocation and stuff like that,
yeah.
but not, you know, brain power for things that primates have, you know, for example. You know, that certain like corvids, you know, birds have really good problem solving, but, you know, they don't have you know, the language skills that humans have. So there's a lot of science fiction stories that I've read have addressed this issue. I remember this one story where, like, on another planet, we find these turtle-like creatures, and we just start using them for food until somebody realizes that the patterns that they were making in the sand as they crawled through the sand were these complex mathematical equations. So they said, oh, well, they maybe they're intelligent. We shouldn't be eating them, you know?
Well, and that's only shades of gray away from what many people believe about the animals we eat today.
Yeah.
It's like, where's our line in the sand?
Yeah. I do think you can draw lines, but
you can't, everybody draws a line. That's the important point, right? Is that, like, I may draw my line at cetaceans, elephants, and great apes. Other people might draw their line at the fruit fly, but everybody has a line.
Yeah, right. Or cicadas, you know. It's a continuum. Intelligence is a continuum, and intelligence is multifaceted, so you can't impose one definition on it. But it's good to recognize that, and when we think about other species, you know, they might not have human type intelligence, but they may be intelligent in other ways, and it would be absolutely fascinating to encounter alien species which may have even different in type of intelligence still. One of my favorite Earthbound examples are like octopus. You know, they're incredibly intelligent, but just a very different kind of intelligence than typically think of as intelligence. But they can do incredible, you know, problem solving, for example.
Birds, crows, how about them?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think what I'm tapping into from the emailer, though, is in arguing that dolphins are wise because they have not destroyed the planet, or that dolphins are intelligent because they have not destroyed the planet, is actually, there's a difficulty in that argument because it implies that they would even have the capability to do so.
Yeah, it's not a fair test because they don't have the capability of doing it.
Yeah, and I think the technology component of that is an important component. And, you know, how we define technology, tool use, whatever. But humans have managed to accelerate technology to the point where we have destructive power that we didn't have in the past.
Yeah, show me a species with the capability of self-destruction who chooses not to, you know, and has the wisdom and the self-restraint and the social structure, whatever is necessary. They'll do what they need to do to not be destructive to their environment, to other species, to each other, you know. You don't get credit for not doing something you can't do in the first place.
Exactly. I think that's the crux of this issue for sure.
But definitely keep a fluid, sort of open mind about what intelligence is. It is not one simplistic thing. All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. There is a theme this week. The theme is inspired by an interview that we're going to air on next week's show. Okay. We're going to be talking with Andy Weir, who's coming out with his third book, Project Hail Mary, which is excellent. And the interview is a lot of fun. He's a super fun guy to talk to. But the theme this week is local stars, meaning stellar systems.
Lord. Good luck, Kara.
Here they are. Item number one. The closest Earth-like planet orbiting a sun-like star in the habitable zone is Ross 128b, just 11 light years from Earth. Item number two, there is an estimated 14,600 stars within 100 light years of Earth, but most are unknown. And item number three, the majority of stars within our section of the Milky Way are single stars, not part of a multi-star system. There they are. Kara, go first.
Bro, I have no idea. Let's see if I can reason.
Think your way through it. Reason your way through it, Kara.
I'm going to try. But sometimes reasoning requires that you have previous knowledge.
That is true.
So here we go. All right. The closest Earth-like planet orbiting a sun-like star. There's a lot of caveats here. Okay. Earth-like planet. Does that mean rocky and within a habitable zone? Is that what you mean by Earth-like?
Well, it says in the habitable zone. It's one of the, it's a separate criteria. So okay. Earth-like, we'll say Earth-like is a terrestrial rocky planet that is not big enough to be a super Earth or a Neptunian planet, you know?
Okay. All right, so the closest thing that's like Earth orbiting a star that's like the sun within a habitable zone, so the closest kind of Earth candidate is Ross 28b, 11 light years. Ah, is Tau Bootes B? That's closer. I know about Tau or Bootes, but I think that might be a guess.
You know about Bootes?
I do. It's Bootes, Tau Bootes B. Bootes, I think, is the sun or something. Okay, or the star. There's an estimated 14,600 stars within 100 light years. These are just numbers, Steve. These are just
numbers.
It could be there's an estimated 14 stars within 10,000 light. I have no idea. No, it's probably higher than that. Okay, 14,000 stars within 100 light years of Earth, but most are unknown. Okay, I see. 14,600 stars within 100 light years. I don't know. I feel like there's more. The majority of stars within our section of the Milky Way are single stars, not part of a multi-star system. What the hell is a multi-star system? Isn't being in the Milky Way mean it's part of a...
No, no. In other words, like a binary star or trinary star, like two stars in one system.
I think that's actually not... I mean, I know binary stars are common, but I definitely remember when I took stellar astronomy, it would be like a thing. Like, see that star? It's actually two. Ooh. And we didn't do that with like every star in the sky. We only did it with like a handful of them. So, I don't know. That seems reasonable. I'm going to say it's the 100 light years of Earth, 14,600 stars. I'm going to say it's more stars than that. Just like, there's just hella stars out there. Like, just way more than that is my guess.
Okay. Evan?
Closest Earth-like planet orbiting a sun-like star. Did we talk about this on the show? We've talked about close habitable zone Earth-like planets. I just can't remember if it was, a sun-like star, and was it only 11 light years from Earth? If this one's the fiction, it's going to be one of those two things that is not right. So I don't know. All right, but then 14,600 stars within 100 light years of Earth. That sounds kind of close, but it's actually quite vast. Most are unknown, so they're assumed because of gravitational influences, I suppose, on other things that we are observing. That sounds kind of right to me. I have a feeling that one's right. And then the last one, where the majority of stars within our section of the Milky Way are single stars, not part of a multi-star system. That one could be right because we're kind of out on one of the spiral arms, so maybe those arms do have patterns in which there are more individual stars, single stars, as opposed to as you get more towards the center of the Milky Way. So I guess it's Ross 128b, one of those components. It makes it incorrect. I just don't know which one. I'd say that's the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Okay, so the closest Earth-like planet orbiting a sun... Ross 128b. It's 11 light years from Earth. I am not sure at all about any of that, other than I do know that it's not that far away. So I think 11 light years sounds correct. I don't know. I think that one is true. That one kind of smacks as true to me. The second one, there's an estimated 14,600 stars within 100 light years of Earth. I'm going to go on to the third one real quick. Majority of stars within our section of the Milky Way are single stars. Well, I mean, I think I know that one to be true as well. And if anything with number two, Kara said you thought it would be more, and I think it would be less than that. That's a lot of stars within 100 light years. I think we'd be finding a lot more planets. Exoplanets, if that were the case. So I think that one's a fiction.
Okay, and Bob.
I'm kind of disappointed in myself that this isn't more obvious, but Ross 128b, 11 light years from Earth, I guess Proxima Centauri doesn't really qualify. I agree with Jay, 14,600 stars sounds like too much, but 100 light year sphere, you know, that's just the radius. You know, that's a 200 light year diameter. That's kind of big, I guess. Maybe that makes more sense. Maybe that is possible. But what strikes me the most, though, is that the majority of stars within our section of the Milky Way, section's kind of ambiguous. Either way, it's gargantuan.
It's basically that we could see, you know what I mean? Like our local area.
So, but regardless, my understanding was that most stars were multi-stars. So, and you're saying a majority are singlets? No, I'll say that's fiction.
Okay, so you guys are all spread out.
We are spread out like the stars at
night. Steve loves it. He loves it.
I do. That means I balanced it well in each item. So I guess we'll take these in order. The closest Earth-like planet orbiting a sun-like star in the habitable zone is Ross 128b, just 11 light years from Earth. Evan, you are all by your lonesome.
Yeah, I feel like one of these stars in the Milky Way. You know,
that this one is the fiction. The rest of you think this one is science, and this one is the fiction. Good job, Evan.
Evan,
is it the 11 light years?
Did you go first?
No, it's the sun-like star. So I looked at all of the exoplanets, like within 50 light years of Earth, because they're. They're listed.
Good job, Evan.
Thanks.
There's none that meets these criteria. There's none. So either it's like a super Earth, or it's outside the habitable zone, or most of them are red dwarfs.
Red dwarfs, right.
Which means that they're tidally locked, and so they're just...
Yeah, I couldn't remember which one Ross was.
So Ross 128b does have an Earth-like planet in the habitable zone, and it's 11 light years away, but it's a red dwarf. But so I could not find there may be one. I'm sure there's one out there somewhere. There's some exoplanet that meets all these criteria, but there's none close to Earth that I could find in the list. Number two, there is an estimated 14,600 stars within 100 light years of Earth, but most are unknown. That is science. Why are most unknown if they're so close? What do you think?
Too dim.
So we can't see them?
Yeah. And why is that?
Because
they're red dwarfs, because they're mostly red dwarfs. And they're hard to see. So this is how we estimate it, Evan. It's not by gravity. The main way to estimate is we look at the density of stars close up that we can see. Because the farther you get from Earth, the less the density of stars that we can see is. But that's because we can see fewer stars, not because they're actually less dense.
Right.
And so if you just extrapolate from the nearest section to 100 light year radius, that's how many stars you come up with, but they're mostly red dwarfs. Which also explains number three, the majority of stars within our section of the Milky Way are single stars, not part of a multi-star system. Bob, this is almost unfair. I got you exactly the way I expected to, because if you ask the question, are the majority of stars that you see multi-star systems? The answer is yes. But that's not most of the stars, because most of the stars are red dwarfs and you can't see them. And two-thirds of red dwarfs are single. Are single.
Oh, see what he did to you, Bob?
Yeah.
That was very disrespectful.
Yeah, he targeted.
So most of the stars are single stars.
Works against me yet again.
Because most of the stars are red dwarfs, and most red dwarfs are singles.
Remember when I said at the conference, like, look out in the sky. You know what you see? Well, you don't see red dwarf stars because they're undetectable.
Right.
Ah, shit.
Yeah, that was meant to be a little tricky.
Yeah, screw you.
So, Evan, good job.
Hey, yeah,
you got
thank you.
Good solo win.
Appreciate it.
All right, Evan, you get to give us a quote.
Here it is. I know that I would be a liar or a fool if I said that I have the best of the three Apollo 11 seats, but I can say with truth and equanimity that I am perfectly satisfied with the one I have. This venture has been structured for three men, and I consider my third to be as necessary as either of the other two. Michael Collins, from his book, Carrying the Fire, An Astronaut's Journey.
Yeah, that goes along with what we were saying. I read that quote too when I was... reading about him today, the idea that he was perfectly comfortable being the guy who gets left in the command module and doesn't go down to the moon. And he had a lot to do. He had hundreds of pages of safety protocols to read. He had to get ready for every contingency.
Steve, I think he wrote the 117-page protocol.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Hold on. I think he did.
Yeah, it seemed like he was intimately involved, at least.
And again, he was kind of happy not to be the celebrity that the other two guys were. So, yeah, cool guy.
Yeah.
Very nice. I had a lot of, I was very interested reading about him again, just to update myself. Because, yeah, obviously, we're all very familiar with the Apollo missions, as we said many times on the show. We're fans. But, you know, it was a good time to sort of review his one little piece of Apollo. And, you know, it's always impressive. That's one of those things, like, if any big, big historical event like going to the moon or, you know, like World War II, like, there's so many stories in that bigger story. You know what I mean? Like, there's hundreds and hundreds of fascinating stories.
A lifetime worth of stories.
Wrapped up in the bigger drama, the bigger historical drama. Just amazing.
Mm.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Don't forget to check out our Friday live stream. So every Friday, most Fridays, from starting at 5 p.m. Eastern time, we do an SGU live stream for about an hour and a half. It's a lot of fun. We just chat about stuff.
Yep.
It's a little bit more unscripted, off the cuff, and unedited because it's live, so I can't, you know, edit all the juicy stuff.
It's a lot more unedited.
Yeah, so, a lot of people show up. It's a lot of fun. We play a quiz game sometimes.
Puzzles.
There's puzzles. It's fantastic. So join us for that. Then you can get to that. Just go to our either YouTube page or Facebook page or our homepage, and you can get to the live stream. So we'll see you there. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.